Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women created by go, you know the thing.
Joe Biden is back from the dead.
So I'm here to report we are very much alive.
Hello, welcome to this special edition of the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. The last time we spoke to Henry Zeffman, the Times' newest Washington correspondent, Joe Biden was faltering in the polls. He was stumbling in his speeches. He was losing momentum and money. Now, a couple of weeks later, he's apparently the front runner to be the Democrat candidate to take on Donald Trump. So, I've got Henry on the line in Washington. Henry, what the hell is going on?
No one's probably as surprised as Joe Biden. I know that he, throughout his sort of faltering early attempts to win support in Iowa and New Hampshire and then Nevada, the first three states, he kept insisting, we're going to go to South Carolina and I'm going to win. And from there, we're going to get the nomination. And people, after they'd attended his really quite depressing events, where very few people would turn up. They were overwhelmingly old. They'd get really angry because he was always running very late. And no one really believed him, I think it is fair to say. And as far as I'm aware, people on his campaign had started to not quite believe him because it just didn't look very good for him. Anyway, he went to South Carolina. He didn't just win. He won almost as many votes as all of the other candidates combined, and then had the best 72 hours that any candidate might have had in any election of any sort anywhere in the Western democratic world ever. I mean, it really was extraordinary, the speed with which moderate Democrats coalesced around him, both at the elite level, he got endorsements, but voters too. And he won 10 of the 14 Super Tuesday states at the current count, and now is a very strong front runner for the nomination.
Henry, the really surprising thing for me is that the whole point of having this enormous race, there were so many candidates in the race to begin with, was because Democrats, moderate Democrats, had basically decided that Joe Biden couldn't be their candidate to go up against Bernie Sanders. So they went through all these this other great long list of names that we'll come to. Why did they not just cut to the chase and do this originally?
It's really strange. I mean, the election started, or the primary started, what's usually called the invisible primary, the period long before any states have their say, when people start to set out their stalls, started more than a year ago with a huge and pretty diverse in age and race and so on field. And it has winnowed to two septuagenarian white men. Elizabeth Warren, when we're recording this, is still in the race, although it seems like she might drop out. And she's 70 and is, you know, by some distance, the youngest of the three. It is really strange. And there was certainly a feeling, I'm not sure it was just about ideology, the reason that some people wanted to look past Sanders and Biden, not just about the fact that Sanders is on the left of the Democratic Party and Biden further towards the right. It was more, I think, about a feeling that they needed to sort of skip a generation and find a new generation of leadership to beat Donald Trump. But one by one, those people, from Kamala Harris, a California senator who looked very strong very early on but dropped out well before Iowa, to Pete Buttigieg, who won Iowa or won the most delegates in Iowa and then came a very strong second in New Hampshire but just couldn't win any ethnic minority voters as the race went on to Nevada and South Carolina. One by one, they fell away, and we are left with, it's not even the sort of previous generation of Democratic leadership. The thing that's so extraordinary about Bernie Sanders, who's 78, and Joe Biden, who's 77, is that they're older than the generation just gone. They're obviously both older than Barack Obama. They're both older than Bill Clinton. They're both older than Al Gore. And the Democratic Party has kind of turned itself into a gerontocracy.
They are both older than Donald Trump as well, which is extraordinary that Donald Trump is going to be the young whippersnapper in this race.
Donald Trump himself was the oldest candidate inaugurated for a first term when he won the 2016 election.
And obviously, comparisons with British politics are always lazy and overdone, so I'm going to make one now. But this is essentially like the Labour Party, when confronted with Jeremy Corbyn looking like he was going to become leader, deciding that John Prescott was the man that was needed to, you know, the deputy to the charismatic election winner. I mean, actually, John Prescott is, I think, 81. So he's only a couple of years older than Bernie Sanders.
But it's not just the presidential candidates. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, who is the most powerful legislative Democrat, is 79 and turns 80 quite soon, and seems to have no intention of moving aside anytime soon. And Mitch McConnell, the Republican lead Senate, I think is 78. America has always had a different approach to age to UK politics. I don't think it's just a political thing. I think lots of sort of upper middle class professionals here retire much later or just don't retire in some cases. But still, it is really quite something to behold. And it also means, you know, presidents tend to want to do two full terms, so 8 years. And whether the nominee is Joe Biden or whether it's Bernie Sanders, there's going to both be a lot of pressure on them to say that they might only do one term. Now, I don't think either of them would probably make that pledge unless they're far behind in the polls, but also a lot of scrutiny on who their vice presidential candidate is. In the same way that when John McCain ran against Barack Obama in 2008, there was lots of scrutiny over whether his vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, would be capable of stepping in if he died. Now, John McCain was much younger than Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
Without being too morbid about it, if you've got someone running to be president who is going to turn 80 when they're in office, it becomes a much more live conversation about who the vice president is than, say, if the candidate was in their 50s or 60s.
It's not just an issue about could they last 4 years. There is also the stamina of the campaign trail. Now, Bernie Sanders is extraordinary, his energy. I've been to his events. He is a powerful and very fired up orator. It's not sort of rhetorically florid, but it's powerful and raucous, and sort of, you know, his events are really dynamic, and he does lots of them. By contrast to Joe Biden, who does much fewer events generally, and they are a bit more kind of low key. But then again, Bernie Sanders had a heart attack in October and is refusing to release more detailed medical records in a way that he said he had after his heart. He said he would after his heart attack. It is a very strange situation, I have to say.
OK, we should probably talk about Michael Bloomberg as well, who, I mean, we thought in the UK it was a waste of money when Lord Sainsbury spent £8 million on the Lib Dems election campaign. But that looks like small fry to the former New York mayor spending $500 million on a run for the White House, which never really got off the ground.
Well, it did get off the ground. It just got off the ground very briefly and then plummeted back down to the ground.
Just far enough off the ground to really come down with a bump.
Exactly. I mean, Bloomberg's spending is extraordinary. We know that he spent more than $500 million on advertising alone. He's got a presidential campaign staff of about 200, which is the size these campaigns tend to be by the time the candidate is the nominee, not at this stage, not before they've ever contested a single state, because, of course, Mike Bloomberg sat out the early states.
What are they all doing with that money? I could have probably done better with £500 million and $500 million and 200 people. What is it that's proved so bad for Mike Bloomberg?
Well, he had a very sophisticated operation, both digitally and on the ground. I mean, he opened, one reason he had so many staff is he opened enormous numbers of offices in states, and states in particular that Democrat candidates don't usually necessarily campaign, particularly in primaries like Oklahoma and Arkansas and Tennessee, but he didn't win any of them. And actually, this is a really important point, which is that one possible lesson of Joe Biden's extraordinary run of victories last night is that so much of campaigns, so much that campaign consultants charge candidates lots of money to do for them, advertising, setting up ground games, field offices, maybe it just doesn't matter. Mike Bloomberg had all of these offices. He was bombarding people with adverts. And Joe Biden, who until the morning after the South Carolina primary had spent nothing on advertising in Super Tuesday states and had no offices or very few offices in lots of these states, just swept right past him and won. And he won because of momentum. It just came together for him at the right time. And for all the sophistication of other campaigns, Bernie Sanders talks a lot about having a very advanced ground operation, and I'm sure he does. Likewise, Elizabeth Warren. There was nothing to compare to Joe Biden's head of steam. I mean, a particular example, Joe Biden, when he sort of read off a list of states that he'd won on Tuesday night when he did a victorious rally in L.A., by the way, California is a state he didn't win. But when he was reeling off this list of states, he said Minnesota with such a note of pure bafflement in his voice, because he has not been to Minnesota as a presidential candidate. He did not have a single staff member there.
And we're told, well, when he got to Super Tuesday, it'd be over. Well, it may be over for the other guy. Yeah. Tell that to the folks in Virginia. Yeah. North Carolina. Yeah. Alabama. Yeah. Tennessee. Yeah. Oklahoma. Arkansas, Minnesota.
It was seen as a straight fight between Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar. Amy Klobuchar, who is a Minnesota senator, that's the reason she was doing so well there, dropped out on Monday, the night before Super Tuesday, endorsed Joe Biden. Joe Biden won Minnesota. It was just really extraordinary.
I mean, we should point out that Mike Bloomberg did win American Samoa. How does that happen? How does he win that and nothing else?
It's a good question, which quite a lot of American journalists were sort of scrambling to answer last night. I suspect it is the pure power of advertising, because none of the candidates have visited American Samoa. It's several thousand miles from the mainland. In fact, second place in American Samoa was a woman called Tulsi Gabbard, who's a congresswoman from Hawaii, who no one's really quite sure why she's still running. She's got a very eccentric set of policies. So clearly American Samoan Democrats just fancied throwing a bit of a spanner in the works. But also it means that American Samoa will be a punchline when people talk about Mike Bloomberg for the rest of his life, really, which will be, you know, the trivia question at, well, they don't have pub quizzes here. They have trivia nights, which are much more serious, as I learned to my cost on Sunday. But at trivia nights for years to come, it will be, you know, what was the one contest that Mike Bloomberg won in the 2020 Democratic primaries? And people will wrap their brains for a bit and say, oh, was it Tennessee, or was it Oklahoma, or was it Puerto Rico? No, it was American Samoa. It gave expression to the embarrassing night that Mike Bloomberg had.
A quick look on Wikipedia suggests that the entire GDP of American Samoa, or at least in 2007, was $537 million. So Mike Bloomberg, he could have just bought American Samoa.
Well, he probably did, in one sense. I mean, it is worth saying, it is funny and fun, and I won't stop doing it to mock the fact that Bloomberg wasted all this money. But as enormous as the sums are, they really are just a drop in the ocean for him. Forbes estimates his wealth at about $60 billion. And they say it's grown by $3 billion in the past year. So his wealth has grown by several factors more than the amount that he's dropped on this campaign. And a really important thing is that as he dropped out, he endorsed Joe Biden, which will not be a surprise to supporters of Bernie Sanders, who say that Joe Biden, you know, is part of the corporate and political establishment, just like Mike Bloomberg. And Mike Bloomberg will almost certainly end up mobilizing his lavish resources behind Joe Biden now. And that takes two forms. One will just be money, although he'll have to, because of campaign finance laws here, he'll probably have to do it
through something called a super PAC, which means he wouldn't be able to coordinate with Joe Biden. He can't just donate loads of money directly to Joe Biden. But the other thing is all these staff members who he could transfer over into a sort of pro Biden organization, because one way that Mike Bloomberg grew his campaign staff so quickly when he got in the race really late in November was he guaranteed that he would pay them up until the presidential election in November, no matter how long his campaign lasted. So Mike Bloomberg has this enormously sophisticated, well-funded operation with lots of offices in lots of states ready to go. And it looks like, in some form, they will transfer over to Joe Biden. They'll certainly transfer over to Joe Biden if he's the nominee. That becomes a really important boost to Joe Biden's campaign, because Biden was really struggling for cash until everything changed in South Carolina on Saturday.
Yeah, we should say they've still got a long way to go in this tortuous primary process. You need 1,991 delegates to get over the line. Biden's got 548. As we're speaking right now, Biden's got 548, Sanders 484, Warren 53, Bloomberg 50, and like you're saying, Gabbard, just the one. Is there any possibility for any upset? And who do you think of Biden and Sanders will end up getting to that 1991 first?
You can't predict this with certainty, given what has happened in the last...
and given what happened the last time I asked you to make a prediction a fortnight ago.
Yeah, although, if I remember rightly, I said Sanders and the other two said Bloomberg, so I've fared slightly less badly than the others.
It's why you're the one we asked back.
Yeah. It's very hard to predict, but Joe Biden is now the front runner. I think people would have to concede that. There's another batch of states on Tuesday, next Tuesday. Michigan is the biggest of them. Now, Bernie Sanders won that by a pretty handy margin over Hillary Clinton last time. And if he can't replicate that, if Joe Biden manages to win Michigan, then I think questions will be asked about the viability of Bernie Sanders's campaign. I suspect he'll stay in much further than that, but still. But no, I mean, Joe Biden looks like a solid favourite. But just because people have coalesced around him, just because lots of voters have suddenly decided that they're going to vote for him, doesn't mean that he doesn't still have the same flaws and frailties, which meant that voters were shopping around for some alternative for most of the past year. He is rambling. He sometimes doesn't really finish sentences, or if he thinks he's finished his sentence, the rest of the crowd is totally unclear what on earth he was trying to say. He is 77 and is less fluent and less lively than he was 8 years ago when Barack Obama, or not 8 years ago, 12 years ago when Barack Obama selected him as his vice president, and certainly on 33 years ago when he first ran for president. The other point to make is that he does make gaffes. He embellishes stories. His first presidential campaign in 1988 was brought down when it turned out he'd plagiarized a speech from the then leader of the Labour Party, Neil Kinnock. The last couple of weeks, he's been caught embellishing a story and suggesting that he'd been arrested in South Africa while campaigning against apartheid. It just simply didn't happen. So there is going to be more scrutiny on Joe Biden now that it looks like he might actually be the nominee. There is a chance that Bernie Sanders and his campaign could exploit that, absolutely.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcast or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The thing that struck me, Henry, listening to Bernie Sanders' press conference on Wednesday was his attack on Joe Biden is essentially what will be the Democrat attack on Donald Trump. He's got a different vision for the country. He's from the corporate establishment. He's been backed by 60 billionaires. He backed the Wall Street bailout. And or it's like the Democrats are sort of having their own just presidential contest between a Republican and Democrat. Do you think that ends up damaging Joe Biden, or if he does go up against Donald Trump, they're basically all in the same boat then? Donald Trump can't really accuse Joe Biden of being in the pocket of billionaires.
It's clearly a problem for whichever of Biden or Sanders ends up as the nominee. If the race carries on for a long time, as it probably will, and becomes more rancorous, as it probably will, and Joe Biden did very well on Tuesday, but still from the exit polls, it looks like young voters overwhelmingly favour Bernie Sanders. Biden's got much more support from African Americans, but Sanders has more with Latinos. So one problem for the Democrats, I think, is that Sanders and Biden are so far apart in approach, in ideology, in demeanour, in voter coalition, that it will be a relatively tall order. As much as they all hate Donald Trump, it will be a relatively tall order managing to bring that back together. You know, it is always hard to know the extent to which supporters of any political candidate who you see on social media reflect the reality. But, you know, there are lots of Sanders supporters on social media who say they wouldn't vote for Biden if he's the nominee. That's probably not going to appreciably end up affecting the result, and lots of them won't end up doing that. But as a straw in the wind of the divisions within the Democratic Party, it does pose a problem for Biden if he becomes the nominee, and conversely in the other way, Sanders if he becomes the nominee.
I feel like I should ask you, given that British politics has basically been put totally on hold for what could be months and months on this side of the Atlantic, is there any possibility that coronavirus plays a part in the race? I mean, as we've been discussing, two or three men in their 70s touring around the country shaking everyone's hands when there's the outbreak of a virus which particularly targets the elderly. It doesn't sound like a perfect recipe for success. Are you in the grip of coronavirus? Are you wearing a mask around the streets of Washington?
I'm not. I tried to go out and buy some hand sanitizer the other day, but that's all, which I know you shouldn't be doing. Anyway, everyone else had beaten me to it, so there's no more of that anywhere in DC, as far as I can tell. You don't see many people with face masks here, and actually, I've been taking great joy in the toilets of our offices of judging people on how long they wash their hands, and no one is getting anywhere close to one happy birthday, let alone two. But then they haven't had Matt Hancock coordinating the response over here, which is actually a serious point, which is that, as far as I can tell from over here, the UK response has been much more clear. And out here, Donald Trump has put Mike Pence in charge, the vice president, and they have these daily press conferences so far, although yesterday's they wouldn't let it be on TV. So it was just a sort of print quote press conference. And the start of each of these press conferences basically requires Pence and then a succession of sort of non-political bureaucrats to kind of pay fealty to Donald Trump and tell him how magnificent his response has been, which it hasn't been. Trump, in his first press conference about coronavirus, you know, it took him about 20 minutes of trying to talk about coronavirus and comparing it to the flu to get into how he'd been betrayed by various members of his administration, how impeachment was a hoax, and so on and so on and so on. He did a press conference with the bosses of various American-based airlines today. And as the press conference that followed finished and the journalists were filing out, he said to them, "Hang on, why have none of you asked me about Super Tuesday?" So the seriousness with which Donald Trump is taking this, I think, is somewhat in question. as it affects the presidential campaign, clearly there might come a point where holding huge rallies, which are of course the bread and butter of presidential campaigns, and particularly Bernie Sanders, in fact, as it goes, becomes not a very wise thing to do. And in that scenario, I don't know what the campaign would start to look like. But we're not at that stage yet.
And just finally, you've been in America, what, for now a month? You haven't yet apparently picked up an American accent. Are you used to, have you learned how to speak American now?
This week's weird American experience, obviously, as you said, I've been here a month. So I've had a month of sweet things being sweeter, salty things being saltier, and every portion being bigger. So I thought I'd better join a gym. So I went along to a gym and ended up in some gym class. But the constant whooping was just so annoying. Everyone, I was constantly being instructed to high-five my neighbours, fist bump them, shout that I was having a great time and doing a great job. Anyway, I won't be going back to that. So that was this. I was not doing a great job as well. I resented the fakeness of what I was being instructed to do as much as the effusiveness. But anyway, that was this week's.
That's week's
weird American. Actually, generally, my main lesson from my short time here so far, and it feeds from political campaigns right across society, is that so much of the difference between American culture and British culture can be explained by the apparent absence of a cringe mechanism amongst Americans. People will just do and say things that Brits would find so cringeworthy and awkward and embarrassing. And that's why the rallies are so much more dynamic and loud. But more generally, there just seems to be an absence of self-deprecation and self-doubt, I suppose, in the society. It's very different.
Well, very good. Well, I'll let you get back to your high-fiving spin class, and I'll get back to just washing my hands. You won't have seen this, but there's been in the WhatsApp group of journalists based in Parliament, a senior journalist from another newspaper has been filmed washing his hands, although the video is only 9 seconds long, so Matt Hancock will reprimand him for that. Henry Zeffert, huge thanks for joining us from Washington. I suspect we'll be talking again next week when something completely mad happens, and it turns out you're now the front runner in the Democrat race. But for now, Henry Zeffert, thanks so much.
All right, Chuck. Thank you very much.
All right. It's Chris, but anyway. Chris.
My name's Joe Biden. I'm a Democratic candidate for the United States Senate.
You had people like Margaret Thatcher. Excuse me. You had people like the former chairman and leader of the party in Germany.
Make sure you have the record player on at night.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.